Right, ladies and gentlemen, it's my great pleasure to introduce Professor Rex Brynham from the Department of Political Science at McGill University. Over to you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to start by apologizing to some of my colleagues at DSTL who heard an earlier version of this when I was down at Portsdown West. I hope they won't fall asleep, but instead they will chant the lines along much as if it was Rocky Horror Picture Show or a beloved Christmas pantomime. For the rest of you, hopefully there's something new in it. And what I wanted to do today was to take 10, not really related to each other, but 10 bits of findings in the sort of social science literature, which I think are particularly useful in illuminating aspects of wargaming, whether it's player psychology or outputs or other kinds of things. There is no connecting thread running through these 10 observations. There's a slight one in that I originally prepared it for DSTL, but the connecting thread is I thought they were all kind of cool, and that's it. And I'm going to start with the observation, which I think most of us agree, that wargaming is both art and science. There's a certain art to building an engaging narrative, to the aesthetics of play that suck players into the game, and thinking about how engagement works, and thinking about how players may generate empathy for the characters they represent or others in the game. But clearly there's a lot of science to it too. In analytical gaming, the methodology of whether our finding makes sense, whether we have too many variables, whether we have enough, whether we're able to realistically draw conclusions from the game or games we just run. There's interesting findings, I think, about player and group psychology from some of the literature on gaming, but more substantially from the gaming and experimental psychology, experimental economics, as you'll see in a minute, which I think has relevance. And of course, the data and models that we may use may have a scientific background for them. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take, as I said, 10 sets of social science findings that I think are relevant to wargaming design and implementation. Now, following on Russell King's example of flogging his publications in the course of his presentation, this presentation is brought to you by the, as of today, newly published and free online Atlantic Council report on the war game I ran for them a month and a bit ago in Washington, D.C. on U.S. engagement in the Middle East. So if you go to the Atlantic Council website, it's somewhere there, and you can find it. So, and that's cheaper than Russell King's excellent book on emergency management. The price point is unbeatable. Now, I want to start with an observation about framing. And framing is how actors perceive things, how they take facts and events and the outside stimulus and make sense of them in mental ways. And the point I want to make, and this will run through several of the points I want to make, is that the way in which players engage in a game is not solely determined by rules or material payoff. Players indeed may minimax, they may enter gamer mode, they may focus very much on what they need to do to win. But I think there's robust evidence not only from our own experience of designing and running games, but also from the literature on experimental psychology, that other factors determine how people behave in game. In other words, the framing of the game, what participants think the game is about, and to some extent how they feel engaged in that narrative, can have very substantial effects on in-game choices and in-game behavior. Peter and Perla and Ed have written on the importance of constructed immersive narrative in wargame design. So really, they wrote it in an art sense for the most part. I'm gonna suggest that there's some real very solid social science background for the observations they made. And I'm gonna start with a sort of game theoretic puzzle that I'm sure most of you know, which is the classic prisoner's dilemma. Two criminals are caught. Do they blab on each other? Do they remain silent? If they both remain silent, they'll both get off. If they both blab, they'll both go away for long periods of time. And if one blabs and one doesn't, the one who blabs gets to go free. It's a very classic piece of game theory that's also used in a lot of experimental economics. And there was a fascinating study done by Lieberman, Samuels, and Ross, in which they took what was essentially just a prisoner's dilemma game, and they gave it two different names. They called it, in one test, the community development game, and in the other game, they called it the Wall Street game. And this is the proportion of cooperative acts that players took. Changing nothing about the game rules or payoff, there is a complete reversal in player behavior simply from a few words of the title. when players thought they were playing the community development game, it was a classic Prisoner's Dilemma game, they were much more cooperative than they thought than they were when they thought they were playing the Wall Street game, which dog-eat-dog world of high finance capitalism and so forth, changing nothing else in the game. Changing nothing else in the game. And interestingly, the framing of the game, the naming of the game, turned out to be more important than the player's estimation of how cooperative or how non-cooperative players would be. So the participants in the experimental study, who were students in a class, were asked to rate how cooperative they thought their classmates would be. Turned out they weren't very good at predicting that. So that, in fact, had very little to do. How cooperative your classmates thought you were had very little to do with how cooperative you were in the game. But what you thought the game was about had profound effects on gameplay, to the point of exactly reversing the ratio of 2-1 to down to 1-2 of cooperative versus non-cooperative moves. That suggests that all that fluff, all that writing of the narrative, all that engagement, all of that sticking of national flags, all of the stuff you do to get the players to think about what the game means is not just add-on that you do at the end of the game design when you're bored and you're going to print out a few national flags to stick on their room or write a little more of the narrative. It fundamentally will shape gameplay. It will fundamentally shape gameplay. I think that's a really important point. It's a point that, as I say, I think that Peter and Ed and others have pointed to, and they've pointed to the great power of narrative as a central part of wargaming. But as I say, I think there's some robust experimental evidence that suggests that the framing of the game will fundamentally change the player's choices and enhance player experience. Now, a second, and we're going to run this as a quick game. It's going to take even less time than Russell King's NHS Emergency Planning game, so I'm undercutting him again here because this only takes 30 seconds. But it's not as important as an air crash. The ultimatum game is another game that's used in a lot of experimental economics and psychology, which is not my field, but I think it has a lot of insight to offer. And it works very simply. So everyone, if you can, pair up with someone else. If you're sitting near someone, if you're not, and you're antisocial, you're okay. But just pair up. Decide which of you is player A. Okay, decide who's player A. It doesn't really make much difference. Okay. This shouldn't take you too long. Okay, now listen up. Okay, player A, you have 100 pounds. You don't really have 100 pounds, so I'm lying to you here, but imagine you have 100 pounds, and you get to decide how you're going to split it with player B. 50, 50, 40, 60, 99, 1. Okay, player B, so player A makes an offer. Player B will then decide whether they will accept the offer or they will reject the offer. That's all you think. If they reject the offer, no one gets anything. I'm not going to give you anything anyway. Try to imagine it's real money. So player A decides on the split, makes the offer, player B says I'll accept it, assume you each get that proportion of the funds, or says no, I reject it, neither of us gets anything. So do that quickly. It'll be interesting to see whether wargamers do this differently than everyone else on the planet. Okay, so make those offers. Decide whether you're accepting. Okay, that's it. So can I have a few offers? What offers got made here? Everyone? 35, 65, did you accept?
No.
Accept.
50,
okay. Now, in fact, those are fairly normal responses, even when you use real money, and even when you do it in developing countries where the real money is actually a fairly significant amount of money, say, weeks' wages and what have you. It does make a bit difference what the numbers are. It's £1 million, but there's fairly robust finding. Now, rational utility maximization theory, which lies at the basis of a lot of things, international relations theory in terms of realism and classical economics, would suggest that you would offer 99-1 and that the person getting 1 would say yes because clearly £1 is better than nothing, or at least it was before Brexit. but in fact, that's not what happens. Okay, so these are, and I realize you won't necessarily be able to see the countries at the end. This is the average offer, this is the rejection rate. And what you will notice is that almost all around the world, people generally make offers in the 35 to 45% range, and people generally accept them. And if you get much below 35%, people start rejecting. Okay. Here's another example. These are results from Lebanon. This is interesting because they wanted to know whether being at war actually affects your willingness to veto. And that's not really why I'm highlighting. I'm highlighting that you see once the offers get much below 40%, the rejection rate goes up very, very sharply. There's other work of a similar ilk about the importance of grievance as opposed to just material utility maximization. There's a lot of work that suggests that when people are faced with situations that affect deeply held normative values, rather than change their normative values, they constrain or reshape the way in which they view material assets in order to preserve their normative values. So they will modify the way they see the world in order to keep their normative values intact. There's evidence that when you're talking about something very sensitive, and I've done an awful lot of work on Israeli-Palestinian peace processes, both as an academic and in the policy environment. Interesting experimental work done with Israelis and Palestinians on sensitive issues like Jerusalem or Palestinian refugees. The evidence is that for many people who have a deep normative attachment to the issue, when you offer them a compromise and they consider it unacceptable, and then you offer material resources to sweeten the pot, they are less likely to accept the compromise. Now, that might seem counterproductive, but imagine if Tom offered to sleep with your partner, you know, would you say yes, would you say no? And then he came along and you said no, and he said, well, I'll give you $5. Would you think, well, that's a really much better offer, I'll consider it, or would you punch Tom out in the pub? Okay, classic behavior is that you get punched out for making that kind of offer. I can't sleep with your wife, well, what if I give you $10? Can I sleep with your wife too? And so I don't think it's that surprising when you think of it in those terms. Conversely, those same experimental findings suggest that when you offer symbolic non-material concessions on normative issues, and that can include language, that can include symbolic material concessions and so forth, people are much more willing to consider compromise. Now, my point two here is very similar to my point one, is that real life behavior is driven by things other than maximizing victory points. Okay, it's driven by normative considerations, issues of social justice, fairness. No one around the world likes to get exploited or screwed. So we need to reflect that in game design. And that relates to my third point about intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation. Particularly here, I'm talking about educational or training war games or serious games of any sort. Now, there is a big debate among psychologists about intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation. An extrinsic motivation would be victory points, badges, awards, bling that you get in a game. You know, if you're playing a first-person shooter often, you can, for some bizarre reason, start putting purple dots on your assault rifle or wearing cool uniforms or what have you. That's an extrinsic motivation. Versus intrinsic motivation, I like the challenge of the game, I like to win, I like to fulfill what I think my actor would like to do. Now, there's a lot of debate over this, but there is evidence that intrinsic motivation, so that's not victory points, that's not numerical scores, intrinsic motivation better promotes engagement and learning, that intrinsic motivators better correlate with quality, whereas extrinsic motivators correlate with quantity. People will do things to push the button in order to get the score, but they're not necessarily thinking about the quality of their response. And that adding extrinsic motivators into a game will crowd out the intrinsic motivators. Now, this may be less of an issue for many war game designers, but if you look at the broader field of gamification, there is a real tendency to want to badge things, to score things, to add icons, to add avatars, or what have you, to reward players. And there's a lot of evidence in educational gaming that that actually adversely affects the learning outcomes from the game when you're excessively rewarding players with bling as opposed to the satisfaction of playing the game well or setting even your own challenges within the game. Now, another point, and I made this point at Connections US a few years ago, has to do with the way in which culture affects gameplay. And this often comes up for those of us who are designing games in the kind of foreign policy, national security, defense environment. You know, how can we model Russian or Iranian or North Korean or what have you behavior? And it is very clear that the value placed on certain principles or certain objectives does vary across national cultures. You know, Jerusalem is a pile of rocks. It's a fairly attractive pile of rocks, fairly warm pile of rocks, but it's a pile of rocks. But for Israelis and Palestinians, it's more than just a pile of rocks. You couldn't just offer to build a second Jerusalem nearby as a way of resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, right? Because it means, it has a particular value which it wouldn't have for a Hindu from India. Americans, their view on the value of guns and the threat of national health care makes them almost unique in the world. And for those of us who aren't American, we've looked at debates over gun ownership and healthcare in the US and wondered how it is we're so closely related, because there are national values, on the one hand, about the importance of guns and freedoms, and association goes back to the American War of Independence, the frontier, and so forth, and on public healthcare, which gets to the limited role of government, and so on and so forth, which are particularly intense in the US, or which are significantly different in Canada, and even more significantly different in Europe. And you can't really understand American debates over those things without understanding important aspects of American national culture. I might even add, British views on Europe are particularly British in many ways, and are not necessarily shared by others in Europe and so forth. So clearly national culture matters, and there's again some evidence from experimental work that it matters. Here we have, this was again Prisoner's Dilemma, the ratio of cooperation for Chinese players and American players, and Chinese players, this is fairly old, Chinese players were much more likely to cooperate than American players when they're presented with Prisoner's Dilemma. However, this is the important point that I'm trying to make here, usually national differences in gameplay, at least when we test it with these kind of simple game theoretic games, are not as big as you'd think they might be. This is the ultimatum game, which we just played with the 100 pounds. This is the US split, average US split. This is the average Indian split. There's not a lot of difference. This is the difference between Russia and the US. There's not a lot of difference. Indeed, there's more difference between men and women in the United States in how they play the ultimatum game than there is between Americans and Russians on average. So gender differences, in fact, are more important in gameplay behavior in that particular very simple game than differences in national culture are. Here we see, again, the results from cross-national studies, different countries. A couple points to make. Up here, we have, very close to each other, Papua New Guinea and France, which clearly don't really share any cultural similarities, but happen to group closely. And even more interesting, this is the range of US results, depending on whether it's in the Southwest or the Northeast, whether it's university students or military officers or prisoners. They've done Prisoner's Dilemma with prisoners, and they're much more cooperative than the general public in many cases. But if the US box, I mean, these are depicted as points, but if each of those national boxes is that large, it suggests that knowing someone is Iranian or American or British or French or South African will actually not tell you very much about their play style, about the way they will engage with the problem in a context. We know, in fact, that play style varies at least as much, if not more, than national culture. It varies with age and generation. In China, there's a big difference between those who grew up in the Mao era and those who grew up later, in the sort of more capitalist era. Male versus female, urban versus rural, class, education, degree of market integration, personality type, etc., etc., etc. Moreover, one of the things that does seem to often be a not powerful, but something of a predictor of game style, is occupational subculture. Now, this is perhaps my favorite slide. I'm going to make a point here about subculture matters. There's been a lot of work on how economists think, and it turns out they don't think like anyone else. Okay? There's robust evidence that economists don't understand the word fairness the way other people do. That economists are different people before they even become economists, so it's not just economics training, that a certain personality view of the world is more likely to study economics, that economists are more likely than other people to free ride. So economists are always worried about free riding because they free ride every time they get a chance to do so, and other people don't necessarily do that. They put 5 pounds in the collection bin when they go into the British Museum or what have you. Economics students are more corrupt than other students. Economics students keep more in the dictator or ultimatum game. Is another version of that game. And the more economics education you have, the more greedy your behavior is in experimental games. Economics students contribute less to social programs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I'm not just harassing my economics colleagues here, but it's an interesting point that when you go to a sponsor and they say, I want a game, They'll often make a point of, you know, we have to get inside the minds of Iranians. I work on the Gulf, so I, you know, in the Middle East, so I get a lot of questions about the Gulf. And not, we have to get in the mind of Iranian army officers. Now, I would argue that Iranian IRGC officers think very similar to US Marines, British Royal Commandos, and Iranian diplomats who I've interacted with considerably, if you just swap the names, they could be from the FCO. In fact, in many cases, they went to the same graduate schools. They like the same wine, except for in Iran, they have to pretend they don't, and so on and so forth. So here's a study that was done in the US comparing the game behavior of American university students and American military officers. And a game was designed in which it wasn't clear if you should do something or not do something. The game essentially had two choices. Do you do something? Do you not do something? And the game really didn't provide much information on whether the do something option was better or not. Military officers love doing something. 92% of them, given a choice between doing something and not doing something, did something. University students I know well are really good at procrastinating, and a large proportion of them, given the choice of just not doing anything at all, chose to not do anything at all. Now, these are all Americans. These are all Americans, so there's no sort of national cultural difference. There may be other kind of regional differences, but it's a very significant difference. And this, again, very simple game in terms of game behavior. Now, there may be some convergence, too, I think, along professional lines because of globalization. And diplomats are a good example. Diplomats all interact with other diplomats. They go to the same diplomatic parties. They go to the same events. It's the same. In many cases, they actually go to the same graduate schools. And I think that probably creates a convergence in diplomatic thinking. And similarly, I think a lot of professional military training, although it does differ in different parts of the world, in many cases is strikingly similar. To give you an example of that, not a military one, I was working with a colleague in Gaza, and they went to the Hamas Police Academy, and they were using British and American police training manuals. And they said, well, why are you using British and American police training manuals? I mean, it's supposed to be the Islamist Hamas police. And they said, policing is policing. You know, what are you talking about? It's not an Islamic way of policing. There's good policing, there's bad policing. And so the commandant of the Gaza Police Academy couldn't even understand why anyone would think he wouldn't adopt British and American police training methods at the police academy. It never even occurred to him that somehow there ought to be a religious or national culture difference there. Not only do subcultures, and for our purposes particularly, professional subcultures matter in games, gaming cultures matter too. So we have to recognize, particularly when there's iterative play, when players play a game frequently, which may be true, for example, with military training simulations, they've been at them several times, that they develop informal norms that constrain or encourage certain types of behavior that, again, are independent of the formal rules and incentive structure of the game. So if there's a theme running through many of my points today, it's that you cannot understand player behavior solely from the rules and incentive structure you built into the game. That's an important part of it. But the framing of the game, player subcultures, professional subcultures matter. Now, for those of you who don't do much first-person shooter games, and I don't because my kids slaughter me, so it just gets embarrassing after a while. In a lot of first-person shooters, you do not use a grenade launcher. It's known as a noob tube, because only newbies use it because it's too easy to kill them. And so if you use a grenade, there's a bunch of enemy together, and you fire a grenade at them, everyone online will tell you you suck, because you're supposed to run up and stab them with a knife, you know. Real game players don't fire a grenade into a crowded group of people because that's just too easy. You run up there and you stab them and you humiliate them in certain other ways online. Camping. I used to have this argument with my son. He's now in his 20s. I don't have it anymore. But when he was a teenager, he would always claim I was camping, which means I was hiding behind cover and waiting until he exposed himself to shooting him. He says, you can't do that. I said, David, in the military, you actually do a lot of hiding and covering, shooting people. It's not supposed to be a fair fight. If I could shoot you without seeing you, that's kind of the whole thing. No, that's camping. You don't camp. Unless you're on a server where people want realistic military tactics, hiding, unless you're a sniper too, this is a subculture. If you're a sniper, you're allowed to camp. You have an assault rifle, you have to move around, or otherwise, the rest of the game players will start criticizing you for quote camping. And we have a lot of, again, evidence from various studies on the importance of game cultures shaping game behavior. Some of you might have read Wood's book on Eurogames. in which he finds that many of the respondents in his very large survey that he did at BoardGameGeek say that they'll deliberately make weaker moves against a weaker player because they don't want to win too easily, they want to give a new player a chance, because they prize the social aspect of the game over winning. So again, the rules aren't predicting your behavior, it's the social context of the game. As I've suggested with those two graphics at the right there, a lot of online games have self-imposed limits on certain types of behaviors which are frowned on by their community, or there are subcultures that might permit them that are separate from the main gaming culture. And Anders Frank has found in his study of the Swedish Defense Academy that when they were playing a game on military operations against a potential invasion of Sweden, players slipped into gamer mode where they so focused on winning that became the subculture, win at all costs, and as a result, people sort of forward deployed all their support and logistics and admin units so that they could act as kind of speed bumps to slow down a Russian advance, allowing the Swedish combat. And as an ex-comms guy, I think that's a really bad idea. But players entered into a sort of competitive gamer mode at the Swedish Defense College, in which they were doing certain behaviors in order to win, which again were sort of pulling away from learning objectives. So you have to understand when you run a game, particularly iterative games in which subcultures can develop. So that's true of training games, particularly I think digital training games that people may play multiple times in their career, that players may have their entire internalized norm about how it should be played, which may be quite different from the game designer's original intent. Now, one of the other things I work on prediction in the intelligence community from time to time. And of course, we always say, there's always someone who say war games are not predictions. We always say that to sponsors so they don't feel that the outcome of the game is exactly what's going to happen, because we can't guarantee that. It's a bit of a cop-out. When we run a war game, we may not think it's a point prediction, but we think it falls within the plausible universe of things that need to be considered. Okay. A game which ended with a giant spaceship landing in Washington, D.C. And neutralizing nuclear weapons all over the world would not be terribly useful for most purposes. So there's always a bit of a predictive element. It doesn't mean that we're predicting a specific outcome or the probability associated with it, but we want game outcomes to be within the realm of the plausible. We have to balance that against wanting creative thinking too, but I think most of the time we want game outcomes in the realm of the plausible. Now, there is a growing literature on political prediction. Phil Tetlock in particular has written a lot on it, which I think is very useful. And there's some interesting lessons there, which I think apply to wargaming and the participants we have in them. We've discovered that cognitive style may matter, and this is a sad thing for me to say as a PhD and university professor, that cognitive style may matter more than formal expertise. There's actually no correlation between having a PhD and your ability to predict political events. Sadly, it's very sad for us in political science. Instead, in Tetlock's work, he highlights the difference between hedgehogs and foxes. Hedgehogs know a lot about a single topic. They have a very clear paradigm. Foxes think the world is an uncertain, confusing place full of grays. They know a little bit about a lot of stuff. Foxes do far better at prediction than hedgehogs do. So people who have analytical certainty and a clear paradigm tend to do much worse at prediction. People have more eclectic and complicated, and even in a sense, less confident view of what can be done with prediction tend to be better at prediction. We found that internally within the Canadian intelligence community too, when we've done some sort of cognitive style profiling of analysts. Updating is important, Bayesian updating. Getting new data and adjusting your sense of probabilities of outcomes is important, and people who do that better tend to be better at prediction than those who sort of stick to their first prediction and sort of sunk investments in their initial position and won't change. Aggregate assessments tend to outperform individual ones, that there's some wisdom in crowds, and diverse teams tend to outperform homogeneous ones. And I think one of the reasons for the latter, indeed for both of those findings, is that when you have diverse aggregate teams, the combination of people in the room tends to generate ideas that none of them would have thought of individually. So it tends to generate a broader array, a broader palette of creative choices than having either a smaller group or a bunch of like-minded people all in the same room. Long-term forecasting is unreliable. And unflinching postmortems and accountability help. That going back and seeing how accurate you turned out to be is a useful way of improving in the intelligence community your sort of longer term track record. Now, We do, of course, do after-action reviews in war games, but I suspect that there are the number of war games where someone has gone back 5 or 10 years later to see whether that war game, in fact, usefully suggested a world that came to pass or whether it was right off base. I suspect that that kind of after-action review, going back through the archives and saying, okay, it's X years later, how right was this, how wrong was this, how useful was this in retrospect, is something we almost never do. And that would be extraordinarily useful in terms of, well, Matt's waving his hands, but if you're close to being a one-man band on that, Matt, as you know. In fact, if you've ever tried to Freedom of Information request material from old, unclassified material from old US war games, the Title X in particular, they actually can't find it. I mean, I had one of my graduate students did it, and it was like barking up a tree because everyone had kind of lost it and didn't know where it was, and that person had gone, and maybe it was on their drive, and there was no central puzzle. It's changing now with some of the pressure, but we don't go back and look at old games and see how useful were they and why were they useful, or if this game turned out to be fundamentally misleading in some way, what was it about the game? And I don't even think in many cases we document the games well enough that we can actually go back and make sense of what they were saying at the time. If we did that, I think that would be extraordinarily useful. I think we have a sort of a vast archaeology of old games we could look at that we could learn a great deal from. Let me say some things about threats, deterrence, and signaling, because threats and deterrence are often key parts of war games, whether they're fundamentally about deterrence or whether it's simply the bluff and double bluff of combat operations. Deterrence theory and a lot of international relations theory about deterrence still remains, whether explicitly or implicitly, deeply rooted in rationalist assumptions about how deterrence works, about how much capability I have, and how credible my threats are. So a lot of the sort of mainstream material will say you have to engage in costly bargaining, you have to, the best way of playing chicken is to blindfold yourself, is to, you know, chain the steering wheel so you can't possibly swerve, and therefore your rational opponent will swerve because the choices are, you know, mutual death versus swerving. That's a lot of deterrence about that. That's why we have tripwires deployed in Korea, maybe the Baltics, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Except for we increasingly know that deterrence and threats don't work that way. Not with real people. Partly, Jervis made this argument in the 70s, it's because the other side doesn't perceive what we're doing in the same way we perceive it. So there's asymmetries of perception. We carefully think we will send out this threat or warning, but in fact it's understood by others in ways different than intended. Social constructivism came along in the 1990s and said that interests are socially constructed, they're a little less material than people think, which makes it hard to engage in rationalist calculations about what parties are prepared to risk or lose in a confrontation. And even more recently, there's a lot of work on cognitive psychology, which raises really fundamental questions about the way in which we rationally assess threats and costs and risks and so forth. Now, some of you who were at the, either read Zones of Control or were at the Connections Conference at Quantico a few years ago in the US, Thomas Schelling made this point that when they ran the Paul Mill games in the 60s at RAND, they were struck by how often one side would carefully construct a signal and the other side would completely miss it, not recognize it as a signal or thought, think that it was signaling something else entirely. His explanation for that actually was largely an interpersonal coalition building organizational one, that signals were a function of the internal politics of the sending group and were compromises amongst various actors in blue, and for that reason they were incomprehensible to red because they were really a function of in-group negotiations, not really how Red would respond to it. Janice Stein has a piece published last year, which I think has a lot of insights from cognitive psychology into deterrence, which are relevant. People have a preference for simplicity, so they tend to narrow down the range of factors they're considering when we're talking about signaling. They don't like ambiguity and dissonance. They're predisposed to listen to hawks. They tend to magnify threat, particularly under conditions of crisis. They resist updating, again, particularly into conditions of crisis, so that Bayesian updating doesn't occur. Point was made earlier, they're very poor at estimating probability. They have heightened sensitivity to relative losses. And that there are, and this is a point she makes particularly strongly, there are fundamental psychological linkages between emotion and reason, and our sort of classic separation of emotional thinking versus rational thinking simply makes no sense given the way the brain works. They are, in fact, not different processes cognitively, and that we have artificially treated them as dichotomies. And that helps to explain why rational thinking is also emotional thinking in a variety. variety of ways, particularly when issues like fear, anger, humiliation are injected into the process. Point number nine on games and learning. Research shows that simulation games-based learning is moderately effective. It is not universally better than other kinds of methods. It's not universally better than lectures or reading or just small group discussion. And how effective it is, and this is, I think, a problem with a very, very large proportion of the literature on games-based learning, depends on context. It depends partly on the design of the game, but it also depends on how the game is implemented. You can have a great game implemented by someone who's doing a very poor job, and no matter how good the game is, the result isn't terribly useful. You can also take really bad games and implement them in a way in which you're encouraging students to be critical about the weaknesses of the game, in which a really bad game can be a terrific learning experience. If you're encouraging them to think critically, why do you think this game is wrong? How do you think the underlying model is wrong? How would you model it differently, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So design matters, implementation matters, how you integrate the game into your broader course curriculum. So this, all too often, I'll get a call, and sometimes I'll say yes because they're paying me, but I'll get a call and say, we'd like to run a game in this course. And I say, well, you know, how does it fit? Doesn't matter, it'd be cool. Let's have it at the end, students will love it. Yep, but how, you know, what are you lecturing before? Are you lecturing afterwards? How you get, it doesn't matter, just run a game for us. It's not terribly effective. Everyone has fun, I have fun, students have fun. But whether they're actually learning anything is another question, because they've just dumped the game into the middle of the course without any thought about integration to the rest of the material for that course. And of course, a game's effectiveness in terms of broader learning is going to have to do with how well the course is designed. So, you know, you can have a game that's well integrated into a badly designed course, which is also going to have negative effects. And the point I would make, and I made this point on PacSims a while back, is that if any of these are zero or negative, you can get a negative outcome. In other words, you can have a great game and it can be well integrated, but if it's facilitated really, really badly, you're not going to get very positive learning outcomes. And so on and so forth. There's some evidence in this. There's a reasonably popular online undergraduate international relations simulation called Statecraft. Some of you may have seen it. There's quite a few findings that suggest it's fairly effective at promoting learning objectives. And then there was a study done at the University of Toronto which found it was awful. Exactly the same game. How to square those findings. All had to do with implementation, the way it was implemented in the course, the way it was facilitated, explained, et cetera, was different in Toronto, and so the experimental outcomes of how much were you learning from the game were a function not of the game design, which was constant across the two courses, but the way it was facilitated, the way it was integrated the course, and so on and so forth. I do think we have to be careful about over-evangelizing the value of games-based learning without pointing to all those other things. You cannot just get a game, throw it at a learning problem, and expect the result to be positive without thinking about the contextual employment of it. I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that. I'd also add, very often you'll see lectures on games-based learning prefaced by someone's schema of learning styles. There's virtually no evidence that the learning styles you will find popping up all the time, particularly if you've ever done a course in the UK on mentorship, where half the course will be learning styles, except for someone made that up. And no one's ever tested if they exist, and no one's ever tested if it's dependent on the material that they're trying to learn. Most of the literature on learning style is very, very poorly grounded in actual research evidence. It's literally someone thinking of a schema of 3 to 6 ways we learn, it's usually somewhere in that range, and describing them and assuming that they exist, and everyone's sort of trying to slot their experience into their categories. A final point I would make before we can throw it open for broader discussion is to recognize that social dynamics are often nonlinear. And we know that for lots of things. This is a graph here, I know you can't see it, about sort of degree of repression and political stability, and it shows that a lot of repression can be stable and a lot of democratic freedom can be stable, but it's kind of in the middle ground where political instability increases. There's a lot of things that in fact have that kind of curvilinear shape. Corruption. There's a lot of evidence that corruption is not always destabilizing. It depends how much of it is, it depends on how people frame it, and so on and so forth. Protests and how they affect instability. It's not a straight line, it's curvilinear. Political patronage, can have declining returns, that a little bit of patronage can buy you some political stability. You engage in a lot more political patronage, it becomes less and less valuable in terms of buying support. Systems can be homeostatic, in which they self-correct. The Middle East was, from 1970 up to 2011, the most stable region in the world, outside Western industrial democracies. People don't think of that, but it really was. Think how Saddam stuck there until the US Army and the British Army removed him. Until 2011, when suddenly we had cascading system failures across the region. We had regimes overthrown, we had regimes seriously threatened, and now it's gone back to a degree of homeostatic stability. All too often, game designs assume linear relationships between A and B. Kind of easy to do. You have sort of more chips, more markers, more of this, you get more of this effect. And often, social effects, in fact, are not nice, smooth, linear relationships. They decline, they're curvilinear, and so on and so forth. So I think whenever you're designing a game in which you're modeling social effects, if you have a nice, even relationship between more information operations means more popularity, really? I mean, if you hear the same television ad 42 times in an average television viewing evening, are you more convinced to buy the product? Really, is that the way it works in your real world? If you like cheese, if you eat infinite amounts of cheese, do you continue to get happier? Or is there a certain point when you're on your eighth kilo of cheese that, you know, the utility value of cheese is starting to decline? We all know that's true with beer. It's true of a great number of things. And so I think that it's important to recognize when you're designing a game, if you're making nice, neat linear relationships between variables, particularly social variables, you really need to ask, is that actually the case, or is that simply an artifact of game design because it's easier to do, that more of A leads to more of A, B, and more positive effects. On the slides, which will be posted, you'll find all the references for those of you who want to look them up, so they're there. At that point, those are my 10 interesting things. I have actually no more interesting things to say. That's it. I'm completely out. I'm really boring and dull for the rest of the conference. But if there are any comments, questions, violent disagreements, this would be the point at which to register them.